Know that all lives matter. This action focuses on Black lives for obvious reasons. We are targeted here in the U.S. when it comes to over policing, but we do see the overlap of, you know, the racial profiling of Hispanics and Latinos. We do see the aggression against Native Americans. We do see the economic warfare that's happening to individuals in other countries by what we call economic hitmen.
And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for January 15th, 2015. I'm Esther Averam.
And I'm Michael Byfield.
Well, when the Reverend Martin Luther King was gunned down in 1968 in Memphis, where he had gone to support striking sanitation workers, the workers in that city marched with those iconic signs that read, "I am a man." Today, on the day that King would have been 86 years old, the signs carried by protesters of police killings and violence convey the same but broader affirmation that Black lives matter. It is not lost on today's generation of activists that signs in this century need the same messages or that some of the same chants need to be chanted. Back then, when the apparatus of domestic state violence and terror came out from beneath its white sheet or some other flimsy cover like the White Citizens Council or the John Birch Society, it came out precisely to beat, maim, and murder Black people who were resisting the many manifestations of white supremacy. Today's state violence, terror, and murders are occurring under the flimsy cover of a police badge. Sure, police brutality has always happened in our communities, but now almost ever-present video and still cameras combined with social media are tearing away the cover for all to see. And yet we are told not to believe our eyes and ears. If there is one thing that defines today's state terror in the age of information, it is the battle for voice, narrative, and truth. Prosecutors in St. Louis County present false information and knowingly allow a witness to lie to a grand jury. And these same witnesses are then quoted and touted to millions of Fox News viewers and talking heads who call on the real witnesses to be charged with perjury. We watch video after video of Black men being shot dead within seconds of police arriving at a scene. Then we are told and asked to believe that the police made an effort to use non-lethal force that they obviously did not use. The head of a New York police union looks like a parody of a crazy man howling at the moon and the First Amendment, saying that protesters caused police murders. Today we'll talk to Liana Seem, who administers the popular Facebook page about the killing of Michael Brown and police killings and brutality across the country. We'll also talk to Ebony Washington, organizer of a protest that will be held outside the White House this Monday at noon, and also Salima Dofo of the National Black United Front, which is holding teach-ins this weekend. All that is coming up, but first our headlines.
As we head into this weekend of honoring the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and teaching about the legacy of racism in the United States, there are now two Republican Party leaders that refuse to step down after being connected to white supremacist organizations. The latest incident is occurring as the Republican National Committee prepares for its annual winter meetings this week in San Diego. On New Year's Eve, Michigan RNC Committee Dave Ajima posted on Facebook an essay from American Renaissance, a white supremacist newsletter. The article, which Ajima said he found very enlightening, argued that, quote, "Blacks are different by almost any measure to all other people. They cannot reason as well. They cannot communicate as well. They cannot control their impulses as well. They are a threat to all who cross their paths, black and non-black people alike," end quote. Ajima has since deleted the Facebook post, but refuses to apologize or to resign from the GOP's governing body.
Meanwhile, here in D.C., activists protested Tuesday afternoon outside a happy hour at the National Republican Club of Capitol Hill, sponsored by Steve Scalise, the Republican congressman from Louisiana, who made a stump speech before an organization affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazi extremists. Greg Billings, an activist with Color of Change who attended the rally, told producer Laura Windsor that Republicans have been happy to ignore Scalise's 2002 address to the white supremacists.
Having Representative Scalise as a leader in Congress, a leader who is a third-ranking member in Congress, I think that's unacceptable. I mean, we're moving forward in the 21st century, and by having someone who has ties to white supremacist groups, who's campaigning for votes from white supremacist groups, unacceptable. If you're a politician, you know who you're speaking to. It's the number one rule of giving a speech. Know your audience. He knew who his audience was. I mean, he knew that that David Duke was a fan favorite of that audience. So he knew what he was doing.
KKK, go away. Racist, sexist, anti-gay. KKK, go away.
Carlos A. Sanchez, coordinator of political campaigns for People for the American Way, said that the organization intends to continue to turn up the heat on Scalise and the Republicans.
Also here in our area, protests were held this weekend to mark the 13th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay. On Saturday, two people with the group Code Pink were arrested in a demonstration at the home of former Vice President Dick Cheney. Calling for his arrest, on Sunday, protesters, some wearing orange jumpsuits and black hoods, rallied outside the White House to call for Guantanamo's closure. And activity on the Hill, a Wall Street banker tapped by President Obama for a top post as the Treasury Department has removed himself from the running following opposition from progressives led by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Warren had criticized the nomination of Antonio Weiss, who has spent 20 years at the financial firm Lazard, where he worked on so-called tax inversions, whereby companies like Burger King have moved overseas to dodge U.S. taxes. More than 160,000 people has signed a petition calling for the Senate to reject Weiss' nomination to the third highest post at the Treasury.
On the environmental front, rallies have been held across the United States to oppose a new Republican push for the Keystone XL pipeline. Activists gathered in cities across the country to urge President Obama to follow through on his threat to veto the Republican bill and to reject the pipeline for good. A city in Texas has been hit with a string of earthquakes, including at least 12 over a single 24-hour period, an occurrence that may be linked to the drilling practice known as fracking. The U.S. Geological Survey has confirmed two more earthquakes shook the North Texas city of Irving following a series of quakes earlier last week. Previous studies have linked fracking to earthquakes in New Mexico, Colorado, and Ohio through the injection of high-pressure water and chemicals to crack shale rock underground. Also, the Obama administration is set to announce new regulations to cut emissions on methane gas. The plan will reportedly seek a 45% cut in 2012 methane levels by the year 2025, and a new study finds more than 80% of the world's known coal reserves and about half of gas reserves must remain unburned in order to avoid the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. The report published in the journal Nature outlines specific limits, saying 92% of U.S. coal supplies, most Canadian tar sands, oil, and all oil and gas in the Arctic are unburnable if the world is to avoid catastrophe.
In diaspora news, Nigeria has said the death toll from an attack by Boko Haram in the northeast stands at 150, including a number of militants. Despite reports, the toll may be far higher. The government has previously been accused of downplaying such tolls. Local officials say as many as 2,000 people may have been killed when Boko Haram attacked Baga, the surrounding area. in what may be its deadliest attack to date. The Islamist militant group is also suspected in a pair of suicide attacks over the weekend where explosives were strapped to young girls. Cameroon, meanwhile, says it killed 142 Boko Haram militants who attacked a base near the Nigerian border. A vigil will be held to honor the victim of the Baga attacks this Friday, January 16, 2015, from 12 to 1 p.m. at the Nigerian Embassy, 3519 International Court, Northwest Washington, D.C. The vigil is being sponsored by Act for Accountability, Bring Back Our Girls, Amnesty International USA, and other organizations to build mass solidarity for the people of Nigeria.
Now, switching to our culture and media moment, while media and freedom of speech have been very much in the news after the murders at the French magazine Charlie Hebdo, Jeremy Scahill, speaking on Democracy Now!, gave one of the quotes of the week, reminding us about the actual record on free speech and journalism inside the countries of leaders leading that march in Paris.
If this is a moment where the whole world is saying we have to have a free press, and that no matter how controversial or hateful some of the speech is, or may be interpreted in some communities, that we judge a free press by how we treat the journalists or the stories that we don't like or that we're offended by. But on the other hand, this is sort of a circus of hypocrisy when it comes to all of those world leaders who were marching at the front of it. I mean, every single one of those heads of state or representatives of governments there have waged their own wars against journalists. You know, David Cameron ordered the Guardian to smash with a hammer the hard drives that stored the files of NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Blasphemy is considered a crime in Ireland. You had multiple African and Arab leaders whose own countries right now have scores of journalists in prison. Benjamin Netanyahu's government in Israel has targeted for killing numerous journalists who have reported on the Palestinian side, kidnapped, abducted, jailed journalists. There's this controversy right now. Why didn't President Obama go, or why didn't Joe Biden go? You know, Eric Holder was there already and was representing the United States. I think that, we should remember, and I was saying this on Twitter over the weekend, that Yemen should have sent the Yemeni journalist Abdelilah Haider Shaya as their representative. He, of course, was in prison for years on the direct orders of President Obama for having reported on secret U.S. strikes in Yemen that killed scores of civilians. Or Sudan should have sent Sami Al-Haj, the Al Jazeera cameraman, who was held for 6 years without charge in Guantanamo and repeatedly interrogated by U.S. operatives who were intent on proving that Al Jazeera had some sort of a link to Al-Qaeda. So, while there is much to take heart in terms of this huge outpouring of support for freedom of the press, hypocrisy was on full display in the streets of Paris when it came to the world leaders.
Also on Democracy Now!, Glenn Greenwald blasted the legitimacy of so-called terrorism experts who often find a welcome home at corporate media outlets.
There's not even agreement about what the word terrorism means, which is why the old cliche that one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist is though cliched, is so resoundingly true. You can have debates about what terrorism is, about who perpetrates it, and yet all of these so-called experts simply assume the answers to those questions, because if they were, for example, to say that the U.S. government is a state sponsor of terrorism by virtue of its support for death squads in El Salvador, or the Contras in Nicaragua, or any of the other groups across the United States, across the world that the United States continues to support that engages in violence against civilians for political ends, you would immediately have them eliminated. No major network like CNN or MSNBC or NBC would ever call somebody like that a terrorism expert, even though that's a very plausible claim to make. It's an extremely ideological and politicized view that gets called expertise, and they don't even have the basic attributes of what we generally consider to, that makes somebody an expert.
That was Glenn Greenwald speaking on Democracy Now!, and that was this week's Culture and Media Moment. When we come back, How has Facebook and social media impacted organizing in today's movement? And later, organizers discuss how they will be on the ground this MLK weekend. Stay tuned.
Hi, everybody. I'm Archie Bell of the Thrills of Houston, Texas. We don't only sing, but we dance just as good as we want. In Houston, we just started a new dance called the Tighten Up. This is the music we tighten up with. First, tighten up on the drum. Come on now, drummer. I want you to tighten it up for me now. Oh, yeah. Tighten up on that bass now. Tighten it up. Yeah. Now let that guitar fall in. Oh, yeah. Tighten up on the organ now. You do the tighten up. Yeah, now I said if you can do it now, it sure will be tough. Now look here. Come on now. Now make it mellow.
And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam, joined in this segment by Liana Asim, playwright, literary, and media activist based in Boston. Good morning, Liana.
Oh, good morning. How are you? Happy New Year.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And it is a new year, and I think it's a special year. It seems like this is going to be a year like maybe we've never seen before. The level of activism that's been sustained since Michael Brown was killed last year is truly phenomenal. And I think that we'll all look back at this time period as being very special and perhaps pivotal in our lives anyway. So, yeah. And so, you know, here we are on King's actual birthday. And I know that I wanted to connect with you today because you are one of the founders and editors, administrators of this very popular, important page on Facebook, 2014, Michael Brown Death and Aftermath in Ferguson, Missouri. And I think it's important because it allows a lot of us to stay in touch with other people who care about this issue passionately and who are sharing information about not only Michael Brown's case, but all these cases of police brutality, violence, and killing. So what prompted you to start the page?
After the Trayvon Martin trial, after George Zimmerman walked out a free man, I cried immensely. And so when I heard about the incident in Ferguson with Mike Brown, I didn't want to just weep. I wanted to stay connected. I felt that I didn't inform myself enough about the Trayvon Martin thing. I felt guilty. I felt like I kind of let down his parents because I didn't actively spend conscious time with it, not long enough. And so out of that guilt, I decided that I wasn't going to be so passive this time. I wanted to take some personal responsibility for changing the way I thought about it, changing the energy around it. So in the way that I prayed, incorporating it in and being more specific, informing myself in my discussion with other people in my community, in my house, and, you know, whoever, in my art as well. I wanted my life to reflect what was going on in this case.
And so, you just mentioned three things in your home, in your work, in your art. And I know that these are pivotal things for you because you're the mother of four sons and a daughter. And I know that you're passionate about it. You know, has to be informed by mothering these black boys who are actually young men now. So tell me a little bit about that and how that entered into, you said you felt almost a guilt, and that you had let Trayvon Martin's parents down.
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea of a communal consciousness, you know, that whole, I buy into the notion that it does take a village even though we moved away from St. Louis and moved away from our village, so to speak, we sort of create an intentional community, Jabari and I, my husband, wherever we go. And I know that people have always looked out for my children when I wasn't around. I mean, I've been an at-home mom, but I've always felt that I had an intuitive connection with them and an intuitive connection about who I let guide them. So, you know, so they've always been surrounded by people who love them, who are concerned about them. You know, our neighbors in when we moved from St. Louis to Silver Spring, our neighbors there, they were incredible. They were great. The people right on the block, the writing community that we knew, they always took time to speak to them, to talk to them. And I think their general welfare is because of that energy, because of the immense love and concern they were shown. So, you know, I believe in karma. So I believe you reap what you sow in this life. And I felt guilty because I didn't think that I was concerned enough about somebody else's child, that, you know, mm-hmm. that I needed to connect with what was going on more. Mm-hmm. And this may sound ridiculous, but I felt like because I didn't connect, maybe that's why George Zimmerman, you know, walked. And that I should have been more involved and try to find a way to make sure that that wouldn't happen again. I don't want to be the parent that it happens to me before I'm concerned.
Right.
So, you know, so, and all of my choices are informed by how I want my children to be in this world. So, and the page is no different. It's, I want to set that example for them to be connected, to be informed, to protest if necessary. I think this is the first real example, real experience that they've had, a real connection to an issue where they protested. Of course, living outside of Washington, D.C., there were a lot of protests on the mall and but the kids were really little then, or those issues seemed so big. Like we had the, you know, the Million Man March happened while we were in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And a couple of other, you know, large issues. But, you know, the kids were young then, and so it just kind of went over their head. But when you have a young man that's about in between the ages of your own children or the age of your children, we can see, I have big sons, you know, my oldest is big. Our fourth child just reached 6 feet over the summer. The baby is 13 and 150 pounds. And, you know, Jabari was like in college before he weighed 150 pounds. So we're conscious of this whole idea that people see our sweet, well-behaved, well-mannered, brilliant children as monsters or demons, and how ridiculous that is. And so, whatever we can do to counteract these things, there's a sense of urgency about doing it now, not waiting for somebody else to fix it or deal with it or discuss it.
Right. Now, before Boston and before you were here in Washington, D.C., in this area, where I guess I should say that's where we spent some time, because Jabari Asim was my colleague at the Washington Post at that time, but you were originally from the St. Louis area, and you lived at some points not far from where Michael Brown was killed. So tell me about your connection to that community and how that informed what you created on Facebook, and how you've created this kind of international, or, you know, definitely wide network of people online.
I'm from East St. Louis, Illinois, which is across the river from St. Louis, and Jabari is from St. Louis, Missouri. And the first 9 years of our marriage, we spent in St. Louis with the two older boys, and it's about, we live about in North St. Louis, which is where all the colored people live. So we were about 15 minutes from the Canfield apartments, and Jabari's parents actually live about 5 minutes from the incident. And it's living on the north side was quite an experience with the boys. We tried to, you know, keep them safe. They never went anywhere unescorted. But there were definitely some, you know, some sketchy moments. And by the time the oldest boy got to be about 5'8", 5'9", Jabari said, you know, it's time to go. It's really time to move. He cannot walk the streets safely. And that was the summer that he got the opportunity from the Washington Post. And it was just kind of right on time. But because of events that had happened that summer, earlier that summer, several young boys in the neighborhood had either been shot or stabbed or recruited for, you know, gangs or whatever. It was necessary for us to develop a plan. And so it was hard leaving all of our family because most of Jabari's siblings lived there and most of mine as well live in the East St. Louis, St. Louis area. But we had to do it. Our boys, they were both in private school, but still we had to come home. And one of the big issues that really touched us was a young man who lived two or three doors down. He was an A student. His parents were diligent. And him and his younger brother were rarely allowed to leave the front yard. And he went away to college and was at a party of some kind. And someone decided to shoot in the air. And the bullet ricocheted off of a light pole, a light fixture, and hit him and killed him instantly.
Where was he in college?
I want to say it was Dillard. University, where he was. But
he wasn't in the area.
But it was. But he was the only other boy who had reached. Who we thought had escaped. You know, he was like the right one example. All the other kids had either been shot or, you know, had some other issue. And we thought, you know, he had escaped. So it just had us thinking about what we could do to keep, you know, our boys safe. So we moved.
Your page on Facebook, 2014 Michael Brown Death and Aftermath in Ferguson, Missouri, has been an entry point for many of us trying to get the truth and find out more information about what's happening around police brutality and killings in our country, and which has sparked this new movement, this new aspect of the Black Freedom Movement. I've been speaking to Liana Asim, editor of the page on Facebook, and she's a playwright and literary and media activist based in Boston. Thank you, Liana.
And thank you.
Somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. So just as I say we aren't gonna let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't gonna let any injunction turn us around.
We're young, we're strong, we're marching all night long. We're young, we're strong, we're marching all night long. We're young, we're strong, we're marching all night long. We're young, we're strong. We're marching all night long. We're young. We're strong. We're marching all night long.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition on WPFW Washington. That's 89.3 here in the nation's capital, your station for jazz and justice. And I'm Esther Varum.
And I'm Michael Byfield.
And this is our Martin Luther King Jr. birthday celebration show. And we have lots of events to tell you about. So get out your notepads or your note app on your phone. And they start tonight. There's a teach-in, What to Do When Stopped by the Police, sponsored by the National Black United Front and other organizations at 1918 MLK Avenue in Southeast, and that starts at 7 p.m. You can go to MBUF's website for that. Tomorrow, we mentioned earlier, there's a vigil at the Nigerian Embassy, and you can go to Act for Accountability, Bring Back Our Girls, and also Amnesty International's website to get more information. On Sunday, at Plymouth Congregational Church at 5301 North Capitol Street, Northeast, there is the program From Selma to Ferguson to Gaza to Here, and that starts at 11 a.m. this Sunday, the 18th, at Plymouth. The phone number there is 202-723-5330. The special guest speaker is Jaziri X, the hip-hop artist, fresh and on fire from his recent travels to Ferguson and Palestine. And other speakers include representatives from the Palestinian community, anti-police brutality groups, music, and a reception immediately following. On Monday, there's the MLK Day Parade. At noon, there's a rally at the White House sponsored by 4MileMarch.org. And also at 5:30 on Monday at the Blackburn Center on Howard University's campus, there's a celebration and also sponsored by NBUF, National Black United Front, and other organizations. So now we're going to hear from Ebony Washington, organizer of Monday's noon rally protest at the White House. Then Michael Byfield is going to take your calls at 202-588-0893 and also speak to Salim Adofo of the National Black United Front. Good morning, Ebony.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So tell me about Monday's action. I know that it's part of a nationwide mobilization called the 4 Mile March. And
yeah,
in D.C., there won't be a march necessarily, but there will be this gathering outside the White House. So our action here in this city is called MLK Dare. It's Day of Action, Resistance, and Empowerment. So tell me what the mobilization is going to be about on Monday.
Absolutely. So first, I'll tell you about the organization. The organization is called the Coalition Against Police Violence, and we are an independent activist collective focused on ending police violence. We are multicultural, non-denominational, and intergenerational. So we are a vast variety of individuals. What we've done is come together in a total of 23 cities, and as I talk, there are actually more cities being added. But we're coming together to rally in memoriam of Black lives injured and lost due to police violence. We'll protest in the legacy of Luther King Jr. As we all know, he was an activist. He was a fearless activist, and that's what we're doing. We are activating to challenge the government to do better. Our goal is really to end police violence, and we have a list of 10 demands that we have posted on our website that people can take a look at. So the demands locally in D.C., I'll tell you about that one. There is a tactic used by police, and that tactic is called jump outs. The jump out squads is something that we focus on locally here in D.C. We're calling for the police department to end those tactics. Nationally, we have those 10 demands, and each city is going to name those 10 demands. One of those demands is, for example, ending police policing themselves. As you know, whenever there's an action, a murder, or an aggression on the police part, they do an independent investigation. We are calling for an end to that. We're calling for an independent council to investigate police officers and police departments.
Right.
So that's just one example of the demands that we are calling for on that day across the nation.
So what is the significance of the name of the mobilization, the 4 Mile March? Why 4 miles?
That's a great question. A lot of people want to know what's up with the fours. Four is for the number of minutes Tamir Rice lay without first aid after being fatally wounded. Four is for the number of hours that Michael Brown lay in the street after being fatally shot. Four is for four corners of the grave. Four is for the number of minutes we will do a die-in to pay respect to the Black bodies slain due to police violence. Four is for the number of miles some cities will march and many will rally to demand police accountability.
So tell me, how are you connecting this to Martin Luther King's birthday and the celebration of his birthday this weekend?
Well, what we have is a year of activism, and Martin Luther King Day is one of those days we're going to use as an excuse to get out on the street and get the message out about police violence. We will have events all year long.
Does this new group of activists see the connection between what is happening domestically and what is happening internationally as King did?
We do. We do. So even though we say Black Lives Matter, we really know that all lives matter. This action focuses on Black lives for obvious reasons. We are targeted here in the U.S. when it comes to over policing. But we do see the overlap of, you know, the racial profiling of Hispanics and Latinos. We do see the aggression against Native Americans. We do see the economic warfare that's happening to individuals in other countries by what we call economic hitmen. So we funding. So 4milemarch.org, all of the information is online.
Okay. I've been speaking with Ebony Washington, an organizer for this Monday's MLK Day of Action, Resistance and Empowerment Dare, which is going to happen right outside the White House at 12 noon. That's this Monday, January 19th, on the MLK birthday holiday. Thank you, Ebony.
Thank you. I don't want to take no time to write this down.
Never show up. For you or me, life is not promised. Yeah, I ain't no perfect man. I'm shining to the best that I can with what it is I have. And I ain't no perfect man. I'm shining to the best that I can with this mic in my hand. Even though it's feedback, still won't come at you. Put my heart and soul into it, y'all. Let's start. Do you feel me? Where I am to wherever you are, I mean it, I mean it, I mean it. Tomorrow may never come, y'all. For you or me, life is.
And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Michael Byfield, joined on the line by Salim Adofo, National Vice Chair of the National Black United Front. Good morning, Salim. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, sir. How you doing?
Excellent. And it's also your turn. You can call in at 202-588-0893 to raise your voice about anything you've heard on the show today and offer your comments on the legacy and meaning of Dr. King's life, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his life today as we head into the weekend celebrating his birthday, 2015. Again, 202-588-0893 is the number to call. So, Salim, what are your thoughts about Dr. King's legacy for today?
Well, when I think about Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, I think three things, actually. One is that he's always considered to be nonviolent, and some consider him to be weak sometimes. But when I think about him, I think of somebody who actually took on a lot of violence and who confronted violence, and you know, someone who had to be very strong to do such a thing, because not only was he impacted, but his family was impacted, and in fact his family is still paying the price for that. I also see somebody that gave us a good foundation and a good framework to work with. You have to work inside the system and outside of the system, and we had someone like Malcolm X, who I think was, you know, a perfect example of a black man working outside of the system. The good balance to that was Dr. Martin Luther King working inside of the system. And the third thing I would say is that energy that he displayed very well, I think is still alive today and is still inspiring, and it still has a good impact on, I think, today's young people. So we have somebody to look to and, you know, read a lot of his readings, especially his last speech, where he called for black people to take their money out of white institutions and start to put them into black institutions. One in particular, he said, to take your money out of the banks downtown and deposit them in Tri-State Bank, which is a black-owned bank. So I think that he left us, you know, a lot of good things.
Okay, we'll take the first caller. Caller, good morning.
Oh, hello, good morning.
And may I have your name and where you're calling from, please?
Yes, my name is Edward. I'm calling from Alexandria, Virginia.
Welcome to the show, Edward.
I wanted to say thank you guys for having such a great show and talking about these issues. I want to add another name to the list. My cousin Brandon Tate Brown was murdered a month ago, December 15th, in Philadelphia, PA, by the Philadelphia Police Department. Now, everything is still under investigation, but it was very unjust, and there's no information as to why my cousin was stopped by two cops and shot in the back of the head. I wanted to ask, how can I link my cousin and my family in Philadelphia with all of these other movements and stuff going around the country? And it's with a heavy heart, because I'm about to break down again, but my family, we want to rally and we want to support, we want to help, and we want to get help also. So anything you can provide will be great. Thank you.
Salim?
Yes, sir. Brother, if you're in Alexandria, we're having a program tonight in Washington, D.C. at 1918 MLK Avenue in Southeast D.C. It's titled, What to Do When You Get Stopped by the Police. And this is how we're honoring the legacy of Dr. King, not just with the regular program, but with a call to action. And if possible, if you can come by, we'd love to have you come by and we can sit and talk with you and discuss this further. I think that would provide us with the opportunity to have some one-on-one dialogue, as well as there'll be other people in the room from different organizations that are help building this movement that I think can also give you some good information as well and can be a resource.
Okay, Salim, do you have a number or a website?
Yes, you can reach us at 301-836-1826. Once again, that phone number is 301-836-1826. The website is nbufdc.org, and you can also email us at nbufdc@gmail. And you can also see our community action plan, which is posted on the website as well. I think one of the things that we tend to forget when we think about Dr. King is that he was consistently working. And sometimes when we think about honoring him, we think about just having a program in his name. But if you really want to honor someone like Dr. King or any of our great ancestors, we do it by the kazi, by the work. You just can't say, I'm honoring him or I appreciate them and not really mean it unless you're actually out in the community making commitments to make our community better. And that's how you truly honor our ancestors.
Okay, next caller, please.
Good morning.
Good morning. And your name and where are you calling from?
Tessa. I'm calling from Arlington.
Good morning, Tessa. And good your morning. Comment for today.
Okay. I want to repeat this to young people. Dr. King was one of them. He made all the history you hear and read in his late 20s and early 30s. To be great like him, you don't have to be old. You just have to believe in justice and freedom. Were Dr. King alive today, there is no way he keeps quiet seeing the injustice in the United States and the injustice of the rape of women of Congo and the rule of Rwanda by a genocidaire who killed over 1 million people and the genocidaires in Ethiopia who also killed more than the same number. And please, when you go to the White House on Monday, remember the women of Congo. Remember the people of Rwanda. Remember the people of Ethiopia. And demand justice for all the people of Africa, and in particular the people of Ethiopia, because the Ethiopian dictators are financed by the United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That is one of our staunch supporters here, keeping it in the diaspora and making the connection. Again, you can call in at 202-588-0893 to voice your comments in relationship to what Dr. King's legacy means to you, or any other comments you may have in relationship to our show today. On Monday, from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., we're going to have a teach-in on WPFW by the veterans of SNCC and DC Black Lives Organization. And at 1 to 2, we'll have Jaziri X will host a show here on WPFW. That's on Monday, 9 to 12, teaching. And at 1 p.m., from 1 p.m. to 2, we'll have Jaziri X. Okay. Salim?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Question with regard to your organization's first event tonight. Can you give us, give our audience some insight into some of the tips you'll be offering to people if they're stopped by the police? Like, what is the most important thing they should know?
Well, first I would like to say once again the program will be at WEAC Radio Station, 1918 MLK Avenue, Southeast Washington, D.C. at 7 p.m. We start on time and we like to end on time. The program is titled What to Do When You Get Stopped by the Police, and there's a distinct difference as to what to do when you get stopped by the police as opposed to knowing your rights. Knowing your rights is very interesting because the police know your rights as well. That's what they're trained to do. However, you know, on any given day, somebody's mood or attitude, depending upon the police officer, depending upon the person who's being stopped, where you're stopped, all the environment, all of those different things play a factor to when you get stopped by the police. So just because you know your rights, that doesn't, you know, really mean much. It's the interaction, the social interaction, that relationship that that person has to the police officer. Is the police officer small? Is that person tall? Are you tall? Are you short? Is it dark outside? Is it raining? Is it cold? And all of these things play a factor. And so once the police officer stops you, what we're trying to educate people on, it's more about learning how to not let the situation escalate, keeping the situation calm, and not letting it get out of control to where it could become a dangerous situation. So that's something completely different from knowing your rights. I think most people know they have the right not to consent to a, well, I would tell you, not most people know, but you do have the right not to consent to a search. You do have rights in terms of what kind of information that, you know, you want to give or do not want to give. But I think ultimately you have to be discerning and pay attention to the situation and ask yourself, what do I need to do to make it out of this situation alive? So those are some of the things that we'll be going over tonight. We have Brother Ron Hampton from the National Black Police Association. We have Sister Seema from the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. We also have Stuart Anderson from Family and Friends of Incarcerated People, and also our brother Jonathan Stith from the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, who put out the report every 28 hours, Operation Ghetto Storm. And all of these folks have a lot of information to educate people on, one, their rights, but two, which is extremely important, and it's what to do when you get stopped, because knowing what to do can make sure that you stay alive, because there are plenty of people who've known their rights, but, you know, ended up deceased or ended up being brutalized.
Okay, we'll take another call. Again, the number is 202-588-0893 to call in. Caller?
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
Excellent. Your name and where you calling from?
This is Randy calling from Columbia Heights.
Okay, Randy. What are your comments on Martin Luther King's legacy? And
I met him when I was about 10 years old. He made an appearance in my neighborhood where I lived in Chicago at a union hall. And I remember running up and asking him for an autograph. And I didn't know any better. I'm 10 years old. But he did so with the utmost of disdain. I mean, he didn't see himself as being a celebrity. So, I mean, that's something you ask a celebrity to do. But my larger point is, there's a tendency to make people in death something they were not in life. I mean, fact of the matter was, Dr. King was not very popular at all with younger people. I mean, Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael had come on the scene and were rejecting this notion about nonviolence. I mean, the phrase Black Power had been coined. And quite frankly, the older establishment in the city of Chicago did everything except tell him, get out of here. I mean, they were very, very hostile to his presence. But, you know, upon his death, people started running for political cover, so to speak. But, I mean, is the world a better place for him? I'm sure it is. But that's my remembrance of him, having met him and shaken hands with him at age 10. I don't know a lot of 10-year-olds that can say that. But, yeah, have a great day. Have a great show, Mike.
Thank you.
Yeah, Esther. Esther, I'm sorry to hear about your loss. Okay. Take care, Mike.
Okay. Salim?
Yes, sir.
I would want to, I was at the event where we had Dr. Umar Johnson that spoke at the Kwanzaa event at the D.C. The Thurgood Marshall Center in relationship to today's activists, in relationship to Dr. King's legacy. Could you speak on that?
Well, I think what we look at when we see someone like Dr. Umar Johnson, who's a great speaker, to me, one of the things that sticks out is his appreciation for us having an education that is centered in our liberation. And when I listen to many of the things that Dr. King wrote about, spoke about, as well as some of the things that he wrote about towards the later years of his life, I see a correlation in the two. Strengthening our own institutions. There's a clip that we see that's going around on social media where he talks about us appreciating who we are as black people in America. And when we listen to Dr. Umar Johnson, he talks about us building our own institutions and also embracing who we are as African people, you know, in America as well as throughout the world. I think that having that fire that we saw with Dr. King he was also able to captivate a lot of people. And, you know, that's important. Not that we want to rely on single charismatic leadership, but we also need to understand that, you know, it is a gift. And when we have people with that gift, we have to channel them into institutions. And so Dr. King was in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he helped to mobilize and get people involved in organization. And so Dr. Umar Johnson is doing the same thing, helping get people mobilized to build the African-centered educational institution. And above and beyond anything else, institution building is the most important thing that we can do. We need to build institutions financed by ourselves for our liberation. And Dr. King built an institution. And Dr. Umar Johnson is building an institution.
I had an experience very recently where we were stopped by a police officer for potentially speeding, and my stepson was actually driving at the time, and he was really apprehensive, even though he wasn't really doing a lot of maybe 3 or 4 miles over the speed limit.
Right.
And what I realized is a lot of our young people are very apprehensive once they're stopped by the police, and pretty similar to what you are going to be talking about in terms of how to behave, because sometimes we're not even necessarily wrong. But how you handle a situation can escalate into something unnecessary.
Yes, it can. Because, see, this is the thing. You can know your rights. But if you told someone, look, I got the right to do such and such, and you say it in a very, you know, nasty way, you say it really loud and belligerent, that person, to some extent, has the upper hand because they probably have a weapon that they have their hand on. And then they're the ones that have to maintain control. So then it becomes the art of war. It's about command and control. And we can almost never win in a situation like that.
Okay. And just there's also, and you know, with Tess for calling in, there's Amnesty International has been looking into police brutality in Nigeria, police brutality in the Caribbean, so this is also something that is very international. I think it has a lot to do with power and the kind of training. So we need to fully understand that as we actually cover this. That a lot of time the psychology of the individual, I guess, with the weapon and how you approach that situation could be a matter of life and death sometimes. And that will do it for Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the Underground Edition. I'm Michael Byfield, and I'll sign off with Esther Graham. And special thanks to Salim Adolfo. Okay, you can reach the show at the Underground Show, undergroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all our past show. Please like us on Facebook and Twitter pages at Underground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice, peace, and love.